Hello and welcome to Spin Unspun, the podcast about leaders and leadership in the world of corporate affairs and corporate communications. I'm Damien Rees from Instinctive Partners, in conversation with the best and the brightest in corporate affairs, asking all the questions and discussing all the topics that really matter to people who shoulder the weighty responsibility for corporate reputation and effective communications. Today, I'm delighted to be joined in the Instinctive studio by Judith Everett, Executive Director of Purpose, Sustainability and Stakeholder at the Crown Estate. Judith, welcome to the podcast. Thanks very much for coming.
Hi, Damien. Thanks for having me.
And also joining me today is my Instinctive co-host, Mike Norris, an associate partner here at Instinctive. Mike, welcome. Nice to see you. And I think you and Judith know each other of old. Is that right?
Yes. Thanks, Damien. Thanks for inviting me on. I worked with Judith for many years, and I'm particularly pleased that she's joined us here today because it implies that she remembers me for more than having a messy desk.
We'll see. Judith, just explain two things for us, first of all. The Crown Estate, what is it? And what exactly is your role there?
The Crown Estate is, in shorthand, a company for the country. We're owned by the monarch by virtue of being on the throne. And all our profits are returned to the treasury for the public purse. And what we do is we manage assets on land and in the seabed. They fall into four main areas. So in seabed, it's offshore renewables, but also pipes, cables, pipelines, interconnectors, so a host of really big infrastructure activity. On land, it's Regent Street and St. James's in central London, so big, high-quality assets, real estate. Regionally, it's strategic land for development and also shopping centres, 16 of those. We also have rural land. We're one of the largest landowners in the country, and we rent that land out to farmers. And then we have Windsor Great Park, which is a royal park, and we run that as a royal park. So it's quite a really interesting range of, if you want to call it, asset classes that we run with a long-term view to make a return for the country. Our purpose is to create lasting and shared prosperity for the nation. And we do that by taking a long-term view with all those assets.
And your role there?
My role at the Crown Estate is Executive Director of Purpose, Stakeholder and Sustainability. And it really is to make sure that we're aligned with our purpose. Everything we do is aligned with our purpose, that we take that long-term view. So the sustainability of our business, that we're setting ourselves significant challenges to really make sure that we do run a sustainable business and sustainable outcomes for the country, and that we have the relationships we need with stakeholders, whether that's political, community, or environmental, non-environmental NGOs that we need to work with, and our customers. So it's a range of those central strategic activities for the company that we need to be really making sure we're enacting and following to deliver returns in a way that we want to.
So just to be clear, Judith, it's a business that predominantly owns property, I suppose, or land. And just so the listeners are absolutely clear, it's things like Regent Street, it's things like St. James's, but it's the seabed and it's the coast, as far as the sort of mean high tide and the mean low tide, is that right?
Yeah, you're really well informed, Damien, and it's quite complicated to explain because in a nutshell, it's land, whether it's on the seabed or on land. And we look to make a return from that in a way that is sustainable for the long term and that will return a generous return to the public purse. But the coastline is a particular oddity because it's what's called the foreshore.
Right.
So it's the mark between the high tide and the low tide. So it's that area of land. But for example, cables coming into the UK, broadband cables,
right,
pipelines, all cross that coastline. So you know, there's a commercial transaction in terms of bringing those cables and pipelines into the UK. And they're very important for many of our businesses.
And of course, because it's the coast and the seabed, you have a lot to do with energy.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that attracted me to the Crown Estate. We have been involved in the offshore wind sector for 20 plus years because we've been responsible for leasing the seabed for wind turbines. And the UK has grown over that last 20 years to be one of the leading players in the world. Until a couple of years ago, we were number one in the world for attracting investment into the seabed for offshore wind. We're still in the top top three. We're number two. And we have, you know, we have a pipeline of offshore wind that's really healthy for the foreseeable future. So our role has been to really help shape that industry, going from being a nascent emerging industry, which really there wasn't much information around. We've done a lot to coalesce the industry, working with government, commercial investors, and other organisations, environmental, especially, to make sure that that sector develops in a way that's sustainable for the long term. So yeah, so it's a really, it's an area of our business that has grown enormously over the last 20 years. But it's, it, the business tends to, our customers tend to know us for what we do on the marine side, which is offshore wind, or what we do on the property side, or what we do on the rural side. And we really want to make sure that people understand the entirety of what we do, because it's that entirety that makes a really valuable contribution, thinking through in a more systemic way how we can continue to make a return for the country by managing. We see ourselves as custodians of these assets. It's the organization's been going for hundreds of years, and you know, hopefully we'll carry on for hundreds of years more. So we see it as our role to really make sure that what we're doing now sets the organization up well for future success.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you came to be at the Crown Estate, what that journey looked like?
Mike, what attracted me to the Crown Estate was knowing some of the people who'd been part of Shell's global renewable energy business when that was a global business for the organisation. I'd stayed in touch, and some of them had ended up in the Crown Estate running the marine business. And so the Crown Estate was looking for a corporate affairs director. I was leaving AstraZeneca. They asked me if I'd like to come in and have a coffee. I was pretty convinced I wanted to stay global. I'd been working globally all my career, pretty much. But I thought it'd be rude not to go and have a cup of coffee. I was quite intrigued by this organization, which I knew purely for its marine renewable energy side. So I popped in to have a cup of coffee, and I was really intrigued because the office was on Regent Street. It's still off, but it's still in the area. It's just off Piccadilly Circus now. But I walked through this little archway, went into a very small, modest office tucked behind opposite Hamleys, basically. But I could feel the buzz in the place when I walked in. It was really, really interesting. And also, I was really amazed, having worked in pharmaceuticals and energy, both really interesting sectors, but you're not surrounded by the product you work on. So, you know, seeing the property around me as I walked in, I thought, this is quite intriguing. So I went, my interest was piqued just arriving in the organization, sensing that energy of, you know, really running it as a commercial organization, but with this unique business model of returning all our profit to the public purse. So I thought, why not, when they offered me a role, why not give it a chance? And I think it was an interesting time in UK politics. You could argue it's just continued to become interesting. This was in 2013. So we had a Scottish referendum coming up. I don't think the EU referendum was on the table at that stage. But you know, I really, having worked globally, knew a lot about global politics, multilateral organisations. But my knowledge of the UK was pretty limited to the health minister, maybe the science minister, given that I was at AstraZeneca, or to the energy minister when I was at Shell. But and the prime minister, obviously, everybody knows who that is. But I really didn't know that much about UK politics. And I thought it would do me good to do a bit of a deeper dive into a country. And I thought, a couple of years, maybe one election, and then I'll move back into a more international role. But it's been such an interesting organisation to be part of, and remains such a fascinating organisation to be part of, that I've continued to grow professionally and just really enjoy what I do, and really delighted that I took that first call for a cup of coffee.
So it was Shell first, and then AstraZeneca, and then the Crown Estate.
Yeah, in a nutshell, I've had a couple of other really interesting for me when I look back and think about how different pieces of my career have fitted together and what I've learned through all the different things I've done. But the majority of chunks of my time have been with Shell in a range of different roles, AstraZeneca, but both in both those organizations working globally.
Well, both those roles, basically corporate affairs and Shell and AstraZeneca, communications?
No, when I started at Shell, I joined in their sales and marketing team. So I was out in the field. I joined the graduate program. I started in the field up in Aberdeen. I was working from home. So I joined this massive, great multinational where when I told my interview panel that I really wanted to join Shell to work abroad, they sort of nodded at me and said, well, we've all wanted to work abroad all our career, but we haven't made it. They were sort of middle-aged men. And so I thought, okay, well, fine, okay, I'll see what happens. And I joined up in the northeast of Scotland as running a territory. It was a real baptism of fire, actually, because I learned the commercial end of the business. And also the company had a crisis at the time that I was in the field. So I really learnt firsthand
what
it's like.
Which crisis was that?
Well, I'm not sure many of your listeners will remember it, but it was something called Formula Shell, which was a, and nobody from Shell will thank me for raking this up if anybody from Shell is listening, but it was a really exciting innovation on forecourt fuels that made your, you could basically charge a premium for this product that made your car work better. The only problem was it appeared to not work very well for Vauxhalls. And so we had, there was a big investigation. And I remember vividly getting the phone call because I worked remotely. So as the phone rang at home, and I never knew when the phone rang, whether it was going to be a mate saying, do you want to have a drink after work tonight? Or a retailer complaining that their fuel hadn't turned up because I had the same phone number. But it was my boss from London saying, we're going to be withdrawing Formula Shell at 9:30 this morning. So you need to be ready to go and see all your people, all your retailers, basically, to tell them what's going on. This was pre-internet and pre-24-hour news cycle. So it was the late 80s. So yeah, it was a really, so my career started more in the commercial end.
Yeah. That's interesting. So you've worked at the sharp end, as it were, of businesses, and you've evolved into this corporate affairs, communications, and more role, which is interesting and different.
Yeah,
and I think it's also interesting that this is a podcast about corporate affairs and corporate comms. Yet your job title is Executive Director of Purpose, Sustainability, and Stakeholder. What do you think that says about how the role of corporate affairs has evolved at the Crown Estate?
Yeah, so I've had three different roles at the Crown Estate. I started as Director of Corporate Affairs because we really wanted to up our engagement with political stakeholders. We'd been quite low profile. Some would argue we're still relatively low profile. I think we do definitely need to increase our people's awareness of us as an organisation. But I'd started to be corporate affairs, to join as corporate affairs director, to build a cross-party relationships, to really make sure people understood what we were about, and also increase the communications activity, which is where Mike comes in. And Mike joined the team to work on both corporate affairs, on corporate affairs comms and engagement. And then I moved into having a chief operating officer role. So I had responsibility for the people agenda, for health and safety, our offices, and also the corporate affairs agenda. So this latest sort of iteration of my role is in a way reflective of how we've continued to evolve the organization. So we had a new chief exec start 4 years ago, and I did some work with him on our purpose. So we've always been purpose-led. We're governed by an Act of Parliament from 1961, which set us up as an independent commercial organization. And so the purpose is very clear. We need to run the business with a view to good management, which means different things at different stages in life, not personal life, but in terms of societal life. And so as Dan Labad came in, he was really keen that we revisited our purpose, which I was delighted to, because I'd been doing some work with a small team on how did we articulate our purpose. And we did some work with a cross-section of people in the business to really understand what our purpose should be, to make it really relevant and gettable for our people, but also people with whom we work, whether it's at a community level on the ground or with political stakeholders. And so we developed this, the words are creating lasting and shared prosperity for the nation, which is our way of encapsulating what the Act says. And we've used that to align our strategy. So we've redone our strategy over the last 3 years. And the three main areas of focus for our strategy are helping the UK advance on net zero and energy security, protecting and enhancing biodiversity, and helping to create thriving urban communities. So whether it's in London or in other places where we have land, all underpinned by economic activity and access for people to participate. So that purpose and the revised strategy, which is much more ambitious than we've been before, and a much more unified strategy than we've had before, because it encompasses what we do on land and at sea, in urban environments, and in other areas of the country, has resulted in the restructure of the business. And I've taken the lead role for making sure that everything we do is aligned with our purpose, that the operating model does make sure that we work in a way that takes account of the value we want to create. So the environmental and social aspects, which is the core of sustainability, along with making a financial return, which generally sits in a commercial part of the business, if you want to create sort of silos for these things. My role is to make sure these aspects are working together. So I sit on our investment committee. I'm on the leadership team. And it's really about making sure that we're aligned with that North Star of our purpose and that we do infuse as opposed to enthuse, because this is about making it hardwired into how we do business, that the sustainability piece of it does come through. And we can't do any of this without the right relationships. We can't do this in a sort of an ivory tower of the world of the Crown Estate. We've got to have really good relationships. So, and two-way relationships as opposed to us telling people how great we are and what a wonderful thing we do. It's about really understanding what people are looking for, what their aspirations are, and what we can do to help, you know, meet some of the challenges in the UK in this case.
You're talking about the purpose that you've built at the Crown Estate over the last 4 years with Dan. What were some of the challenges to getting to that point? Obviously, it's a really interesting organisation with people at the top of their field in commercial property, in residential property, in rural land, in energy. There's obviously the dual parts of the Crown Estate Act, which look at maximising revenue for the Treasury, but also the long-term custodianship. What were the challenges with getting to the point you're at now? What kind of challenges did you face?
So, Mike, I think in a way we've done the easier part, because what we've done is articulate in a language that's right for this day and age, what our purpose actually is. It was already enshrined in the Act. People are generally drawn to the Crown Estate because they really like the role. The role of the organisation aligns with their personal values, even if they might not articulate it like that. When you talk to people, all the time I've been in the Crown Estate, when you talk to people about why they're there, it's for more than what they get at the end of a month. And they really enjoy working the organisation. The assets are amazing. But underneath it all, there's a real belief in the purpose. So I think articulating the purpose took time, but it was relatively straightforward. We did involve our board. We involved our treasury. We involved treasury in terms of keeping them aligned with where we were going. We obviously also kept Royal Household aligned with where we were going. Everybody really buys into the purpose and the strategy that we've set alongside that. I think it's as we get deeper into what this means in areas where we might have taken a more conventional approach to how we deliver value, as we get into more of those investment decisions, that's where I think the crunch will come. When we look for longer term payback for nature-based solutions than a conventional property investment model calculation, those are the areas where we're going to end up having, I think, really, really constructive conversations, but they will involve some difficult decisions. And I think we're just beginning to get into that as we look at what does decarbonizing our real estate portfolio involve. You know, that does force us to look really hard at when we do think retrofit is the right model to get us to where we need to, and where we think, you know, starting again, demolishing a building is the right approach. And, you know, we will be coming up against those crunch issues.
Do you think people understand the Crown Estate, or do you think people are confused by it or just not aware of it? And is that a core part of what you are doing yourself in terms of changing that?
I think people are confused about what – I think most people just don't know about the Crown Estate. People who do business with us know about us.
I think they think it's something to do with the King.
Yeah, and – you know, the shorthand, the media headlines are always, you know, Queen's Property Company or King's Property Company. And obviously the connection with the monarch is very important. They own the underlying assets. But the organisation is a company for the country. And so it is one of Britain's best kept secrets in a way. And as somebody who leads the communications activity, that's something that I want to change and really make sure that we are known for the right reasons and that we do raise the profile of the organisation, but not in a shouty way, more through what we do and what people experience on the ground. That for me would be a real result. And generally where we do work with communities on the ground, people are really positive about us because they get that we're a serious long-term investor. We do want to engage. We do things, you know, really thoroughly. We're there for the long term as opposed to develop and then exit. So I think people's personal experience is really positive, but that's not necessarily fast enough in terms of raising profile. So I would like us to be doing more.
Just to sort of come back to a more helicopter view of your entire career, what are some of the biggest issues you've dealt with across some of the big roles that you've had?
I've always had this mantra for myself. It evolved after a few years of working that I wanted to work in organisations where there was a really values fit, where I felt I was growing professionally and intellectually, and that it would be saleable to another organisation, because I've never been somebody who's seen myself as a lifer in organisations, although actually I have spent quite considerable chunks of time with some of my employers. So I've learned something pretty much everywhere I've been, and that's been what's been really rewarding. So even when I look back to my first role at Shell working remotely and, you know, having to go in and check the quality of the loos in service stations and thinking, what am I doing? But actually, I learned so much about that. And the credibility I got when I did move into more group level roles in communications to be able to sit down with the country chair and say, oh, yeah, when I was in retail, you know, the credibility I got for having been out there, done that, and, you know, managed through various crises was a real positive aspect for them in terms of relationship buildings, but for me, it really gave me a real good insight into how the business ran in one particular area. I've worked in what's called issues-rich sectors, pretty much.
I like that euphemism.
For much of my career, and so, you know, some of the issues I've been involved with haven't even hit the headlines, but I know what's gone on behind the scenes to manage them, and then others have hit the headlines big time, and I felt the impact being someone remote. So in the mid-90s, Shell had a couple of really massive crises. They were really serious. And I was working in a comms role, but in a country at a time when you didn't have intranets. It was pre-internet, if you can believe that, guys. So I was in Oman at a time when Shell had the Nigeria crisis with the really sad execution of Ken Saro-Wiwa eventually, but also the Brent Spar crisis, where the company wanted to, because it was the right technical decision, to sink the Brent Spar in the North Sea as a way of it reaching its end of life. And Greenpeace mounted a really, really effective campaign that actually changed the way the industry manages decommission to this day. So this was like 30 years ago. And those two particular crises, which were really serious, and even when I speak about them now, they make me feel uncomfortable, because the Nigeria one in particular was really tragic and a really serious, serious matter, as was what Greenpeace were protesting about, but a different tone to it. I know how much it changed the organization. Like, it changed the views of the leadership team in terms of how they ran the organization, and it changed the views of staff in terms of really wanting to understand what their organization was doing, and really reinforced the importance of internal communications, because I was sitting in Oman reading the news through, or making my views about my employer through, the BBC World Service, because there was nothing coming out from the company to staff who are not in the countries that were impacted. So it really gave me that wake-up call of, well, A, I need to make sure that the company I'm working for is doing the right thing, or working really hard to make sure they learn from things when they maybe need to do things in a different way. And that it also made me realize I want to be at the core of where some of these decisions are being made, because I think this is a real seismic change in the case of Shell as to how we're going to act as a company. So I wasn't thinking I want a job in corporate affairs. I was thinking how a business does business is really important to me. I'd been brought up in a non-commercial family. I'd been brought up by international development parents who were real NGO activists who felt business was a problem. I believed business was part of the solution. So when I joined Shell in the mid-80s, there was a protest against Shell's role in South Africa. My parents are both really active in anti-apartheid. We had some really interesting conversations around the family table, which has already always had really active political discussions around it, about me joining Shell. And I said, I think the company can make a difference. And I still believe that companies well run can make a difference, but they need to be held to account, and they need to see themselves as part of the solution as opposed to being the only part. So it's a long-winded way of answering your question, Mike, about what have I learned through the crises? A lot. But I've also learned about how to really think about what's the role I can play in that, as opposed to just, you have to respond if you're in the crisis team to be able to help a company navigate through it. But if you're an employee in a wider part of the organization, whether in comms or government affairs or in a more general role, just watch how the company's evolving and what you might want to do and what you naturally, through your own value set, gravitate towards.
And how do you compare and contrast some of those experiences at Shell and AstraZeneca with the role that you have now? Because you've led on some big issues at the Crown Estate. I'm thinking of things like Scottish devolution of the Crown Estate, more recently the death of Queen Elizabeth II. How do some of those issues from your previous roles prepare you for this, and how do they compare and contrast?
you have to take a long-term view. So the death of the monarch was a really sad moment for the country. You could argue globally, the Queen Elizabeth II was incredibly respected, had given her life for service to the country and the Commonwealth, and it made a really big impact. Closer to home at Windsor, she spent a lot of time in Windsor Castle. The staff at Windsor were really close to her. The Windsor team played a really key role in a lot of the ceremony around the funeral, so especially the floral tributes that were being laid. So, you know, it's really about making sure that you galvanise as a team internally to help colleagues who are having to play a more active role, and that you keep. There's a really well rehearsed in that case. There was a very well rehearsed protocol for how this was going to be managed, and we played our role. We had rehearsed, but we played our role, and it was about making sure that staff were being supported by colleagues who weren't in Windsor, so that we sort of ran shifts. Our board went and visited, took time out to actually be with colleagues in Windsor, and that was a really important, it brought the company together, made people very sad, but also brought the company together in terms of being able to play a role and pay our respects, and then, you know, obviously work with the new monarch. The king has become the ranger of Windsor Great Park, so Paul, who's my colleague on the leadership team, sees him regularly in terms of what's going on at Windsor, and he's really interested in the environmental aspect and the social aspect of what we do, and very interested in the organisation. And in Windsor, he gets quite heavily involved in what the team have got planned.
When you compare your roles at AstraZeneca and Shell, big PLCs, with your role now, and thinking about corporate affairs and corporate comms specifically, what are the main differences, would you say?
That's a good question. There are a lot of similarities.
Yes.
And one of the biggest surprises to me, and it still remains a surprise, 10 years into my role at the Crown Estate, is that an organisation that's just one country and one time zone can still go into silos unless you really work hard at making sure you keep the culture aligned and woven together so you get the most out of what you can bring to the equation. A lot of the disciplines are very similar. So how you manage issues, how do you prepare people for communications? What are the areas that you want to communicate about? How do you get ahead of a situation as best you can? What I love is the ability to be really nimble and fast and to be able to say, yes, we're going to do this. And I've always had very supportive CEOs, whether it was Alison, who was Dan's predecessor, or now Dan, who are really keen for us to be out on the front foot and really ahead of where we can be communications, as opposed to ducking down and hoping things will disappear. So I tend to be quite bullish in terms of wanting to engage as opposed to ducking down and hoping things will go away, because I don't think that happens. I think you're missing an opportunity, however painful it might feel, to get out and engage. And then I think it's it is a luxury not having quarterly results and not being driven by the market, so to say. But we've got some really significant international investors in our business. So Norges, NBIM, hold a big percentage of Regent Street. They're a really valued investor with us. So we obviously report to them on a regular basis. They're really interested in what we do. And we also have some Canadian pension funds, Oxford and Hoop, invested with us. So, you know, we have international investors as part of our way of doing business. It's just very different to being listed. And I think it just gives us an ability to be really agile and get ahead of things where we choose to.
You talk quite a lot about the importance of an organization not to be siloed and to come together, and I guess make the full value of the sum of the parts, which I think is really interesting. And I also get the impression that the way you tie it together at the Crown Estate is through your purpose, and that seems to be the defining and all encompassing. I think you used the word North Star. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, our purpose is the aligning principle for the organisation.
Yeah, and so you embed that in your strategy and everything you do, and that is very much your responsibility.
It is, and it's been great to effectively be able to go back to strip back the machine of the Crown Estate to work on defining the purpose, so creating lasting and shared prosperity for the nation, look at what our strategy needs to be to align with that in terms of meeting some of the big challenges for the nation that we have a legitimate role to play in helping create solutions for. Then looking at how we operate as a company. So what's the operating model to make sure that we are aligned with that purpose and delivering on the strategy? And then how do we assess our investments? So how do we look at our investments in terms of allocating capital, but then also assessing our performance against those allocations, and then reporting back out to the world. But we do need to keep working at it. So we've now built we're building the engine back again around those principles, having taken it apart. We're working through what's our value creation framework to really make sure that our investment proposals reflect that longer term value we want to create.
So it would be fair to say then it's a purpose led. It really is a purpose led business in a way that's incredibly authentic, in that purpose really is driven down into how the business thinks, how it behaves, and indeed what it actually does on an operational level.
Absolutely.
So it permeates all levels.
It permeates all levels.
So it's not just words, which I think there is obviously this somewhat cynical view out there that company's purpose is just words. Clearly, the Crown Estate will be a very good case study for a business that is purpose-led, but in a way that's really bottom up.
Yeah, it has to be bottom up, and it also has to be top down.
Yeah.
Because the board have to buy in and be involved in what you're doing in terms of how you define your purpose as, so that they can be custodians of. And certainly the changes proposed to the governance code are potentially going to make it a board's responsibility to really understand the purpose of a company and make sure that the activity of the company is in line with that purpose. So certainly having been part of our process in terms of what we've gone through, having the board involved, we had two really significant discussions with them, and then they were involved individually as we were developing this. So it takes longer, but it makes for a much more meaningful outcome because the board are involved, your key shareholders are involved, and then staff at every level have had an input as well. I mean, at the end of it, it's about a democracy. I know that business is not democratic because there have to be decision points and decision rights, etc. But at the end of the day, I really believe that involving people so people feel they have some skin in the game, get what it's about, can play with the purpose and understand how they can bring it through in their day-to-day life is really important. It shouldn't be the domain of one team or one person. I think you've failed if that's how you regard yourself. It has to be about having it permeate every area of the organisation and then be what people experience when they work with you or engage with you.
You talked about purpose, taking the engine apart, putting it back together. In terms of the three parts of your role, purpose, stakeholder and sustainability, will that mean a kind of balance shift between those three areas of your role, moving more towards external communication and awareness of your purpose now? Or do you see all of those three parts of the role as being interlinked and always will be?
I don't think it'll always be, because I think structures evolve. So I've had three different significant roles at the Crown Estate in my time there. I think we'll continue to evolve, because I think every organisation needs to. So feeling that something will be in one's construct is not necessarily sustainable in itself. But what I would hope is that what we've put in place with this reconfiguration of the organisation and the internal infrastructure means that it's really deeply embedded. So you actually have people working in real estate who are thinking about the environmental aspect of what they're doing, the social impact. It's hardwired into how you do business. So, you know, I'm hoping that the team that I lead centrally will be able to get lighter and lighter touch in terms of coaching colleagues internally, because we'll start to see that coming through naturally in terms of people's way of framing projects, allocating capital, you know, involving other people. And I'd see our role as continuing to raise the bar, because certainly in the years I've been working in business, the changing societal expectations have been really enormous, and they've continued to grow. I think it's important that business rises to the challenge, and I think it's important internal teams act as that voice of the external world to make sure that we are genuinely listening and engaging. So I see that as being probably the evolution of the team: keep raising the bar, challenge the organisation to be at the leading edge of what we need to be doing, but by listening, bringing the outside in. I mean, I think one of the things I've always felt an outsider, and when I was younger, it used to bother me. I think, oh, I should fit in better. But actually now, I think that's a massive advantage for anybody working in a corporate affairs type role, because I think you have to feel like a bit of an outsider inside the organization. Not so you're alienating colleagues, but we have to be the voice of what is expected of us, what's changing, because you know, things are getting more and more volatile. So you could see how what business needs to do business successfully will continue to evolve. And I see it very much as our role and my role in this instance, but my wider team's role, to be a bit of a challenge inside the organization and bring that external perspective in, make sure that we are engaging really widely. So that's how I see the role evolving.
I think it'd be really interesting, Judith, for our listeners to hear who's been inspirational in your career.
I've been really lucky to work with some amazing people, right from my time in Oman, where my chief exec of the business I worked for Shell, John Mills, sadly died of motor neuron disease a couple of years ago, really believed in me, really gave me chances. When I was relatively junior, would involve me in things, visibly, really listen to my opinion, which I was great. Because in a big company like a major multinational, you can sometimes feel like a tiny cog in enormous. So, and he really encouraged me and carried, and I would always talk to him about roles I was thinking about. Karen De Segundo, who headed up our renewable energy business at Shell, had been a real role model for me right from when I joined the organization. She'd been one of the most senior women in the organization. She had a family. She ran the gas and power business. She then moved into lead up the renewable energy business. And she promoted me into a really senior role on her team and gave me a lot of opportunities. So, and continued to be a sounding board as I went through. And then, yeah, have really enjoyed working with people, colleagues like Alison. She's great, really inspiring leader. Did some great things at the Crown Estate in terms of bringing the organization together. So again, being valued by her as part of the team and listened to was really important. Lovely human being as well, which I think is really important. And then Dan's been really inspiring to work alongside, is really inspiring to work alongside because he's really ambitious for the organization. So I've been fortunate to go through a CEO transition where you see the different skills and expertise that both bring. And it's great to see somebody with a different set who is right for the organization at that time and to work with them. So I'm learning a lot as we go in terms of pushing ourselves to really grow, to be as much as the Crown Estate could be. And that's more than we are currently. So I find he's a very tough driver in a positive way, but for the right reasons for the organization to be as creating as much value as we can and create driving sort of outcomes we can.
And that's Alison
Nimmo. Dame Alison Nimmo, I should say, because she was awarded her damehood just as she was leaving the Crown Estate.
When you look at corporate affairs, corporate comms, the role in general, what do you most like about it and what do you least like about it?
So what I most like about it is that you are able to take a view across the organization. You need to be curious. You need to see what's going on. And I love that because I like thinking about how things fit together. I like seeing, noticing something and looking at what the connection could be. So I love that about corporate affairs. You need to be able to see the breadth of the organization. You need to be curious and you need to get information so you can carry on working in a way that's effective for the organization. So I really like that. I like having that overview of the business. What do I least like about it? It doesn't happen so much these days, but I least like it when you discover something that you should have been told about a long time ago, a lot further in advance. And then you get presented with this isn't so good. What can you do to fix it? And it's like, okay, that old adage, we are where we are, so let's see what we can do. But it's just that sort of not involving people early enough. So I don't like it when I see people not giving colleagues access. I think that happens less and less now. But it's the sort of the nasty surprises that come out of the woodwork I do not like.
What do you, from all the people you've worked with and all the jobs you've had, what would you say are the kind of keys to being an effective leader in your kind of role?
Good question. I should ask you probably, but I will. I think you have to be really curious. I think you have to give people space. Yeah, I grew in my career when people gave me space, when people trusted me and gave me space. So I think a leader has to, you know, visibly trust and support their team and back them. but also coach them and coach them quickly when things aren't going well, when something maybe needs to be course corrected, give people that feedback in the here and now in a way that's positive to help them grow. But the biggest thing is being trusted and feeling you've got the space to do things without somebody looking over your shoulder. Mm. And I think that's really important for a role for a leader. And then to, you know, to encourage people, because it's amazing how many people will feel that it's not the right job for them, or they haven't got the skills to get into the next level. But actually, you know, just encouraging people to take on more, to stretch themselves. I think it's a really important part of any leader's role. And it's a real privilege leading teams and putting teams together and seeing people move on to other roles. We've got people who've left the Crown Estate and then come back into the Crown Estate. You know, I just think it's really special seeing people grow professionally and personally as well.
So if you weren't in this job, or indeed doing the role of corporate comms, what would your dream job be?
I think my dream job would be to be a marine biologist. We have survey boats out in the Pentland Firth at the moment, and it's really amazing getting photographs back from them of the dolphins like at the bow of the ship. And it made me think, oh, if I wasn't doing this, I'd be quite like to be on one of those ships and, you know, having to don some diving gear and go down and see what's happening underwater. But yeah, I think doing something like that, something completely different, would be my dream job if I hadn't done this.
Judith, thank you very much for your company today and your fascinating insights. You've been listening to Spin Unspun, the podcast from Instinctive Partners about corporate affairs and corporate communications, with myself, Damien Rees, and my co-host today, Mike Norris. Mike, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Damien.
Our guest today has been Judith Everett, Executive Director of Purpose, Sustainability and Stakeholder at the Crown Estate. Join us again for our next episode of Spin Unspun, details at instinctive.com. Find us on social media, on the usual channels. And if you'd like to get in touch about Spin Unspun, just drop me a line, damien.rees@instinctive.com.